Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. It's our Healthy Lifestyles program, and today we talk about the emerging field of nutritional psychiatry. Later in the hour, Dina Irwin, a registered dietitian and nutritionist at Cape Health Community Center of Cape Cod, she joins us. But first, we talk with Dr. Uma Naidu. She's a nutritional psychiatrist and author of the new book, This Is Your Brain on Food, an indispensable guide to the surprising foods that fight depression, PTSD, ADHD, anxiety, OCD, and more. Dr. Naidu is also the founder and director of the Nutritional and Lifestyle Psychiatry Clinic at Boston Mass General Hospital. Dr. Naidu, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. It's lovely to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
You bet. And on previous programs, we've talked a lot about the connection between diet and physical well-being, including evidence that changes in diet can treat chronic diseases like type 2 diabetes, high cholesterol, and hypertension. I think many listeners may be surprised to learn that there's a growing body of evidence that diet can also play a role in treating mental health disorders. So how long has research into the connection between diet and behavioral health been underway, and what have we learned?
Thanks so much. That's a great question. I think you framed that really well. We're very used to speaking to our physicians about a family history of diabetes, obesity, or, you know, how to eat better for an elevated cholesterol. But no one actually brings the conversation about our brain health, one of the most important organs of our body. The research, you know, really started with decades ago, Mindy, with trials done at Mass General by some of the leaders there in research around things like folate, methylfolate, omega-3 fatty acids. All of these have been studied as individual nutrients. And I think that what psychiatry has done in the last decade or so is really put it together in a composed way. I can't help but bring my chef background into it and say, you know, when we eat a plate of food, it's always a composed plate of food. It's not just one nutrient or one ingredient. And that's how I think about putting the different amounts of research together. And also the additional fact is the emerging and ongoing research in the gut microbiome, which really does lend itself to this connection with mental health as well.
I don't think we yet have statistics that take into account the toll that COVID-19 is having on our mental health. But what do we know about Americans' mental health prior to the pandemic?
Well, if I do have some statistics from COVID, if that would be helpful.
Oh, sure, yeah.
So some of what we know, I'll walk you through, you know, different points in the pandemic. In early parts of the pandemic, around March, April, the American Psychiatric Association did a survey, and what it showed was the biggest concern that people had was the uncertainty. It also showed that things like use of alcohol and other substances were on the rise, and people were feeling extremely anxious. Later on in the pandemic, a company called Express Scripts looked at the change in the number of prescriptions being used for specifically depression and anxiety and found that was up a significant percent. I want to say it was about 20% of an increase. And then by June, what occurred was that Zoloft, otherwise called sertraline, one of the main selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors that we prescribe for some conditions such as depression and anxiety as well as others, went on shortage in the United States. The CDC then put out some data, and the most concerning fact from that data, Mindy, to me as a psychiatrist, was that during the pandemic, 11% of Americans were considering suicide. And that was deeply concerning. So I think that, you know, that's what we know. And, of course, we'll get more data as studies continue. But, you know, I think that it showed what people are feeling, that there's much more suffering in terms of mental well-being during the pandemic than prior, where, you know, the most important and leading condition by three times was still anxiety disorders in the United States versus depression, whereas depression is more of a global burden in terms of health, in terms of disability worldwide. But the leading condition in the United States had always been anxiety prior to that.
We're going to talk in more detail about the connection between diet and behavioral health in a bit, but let's start with your background. You're a nutritional psychiatrist, and you're also a trained chef. So tell us more about your history with food and cooking.
Thank you. So it's interesting. I came from a very large South Asian family with lots of cooks in the kitchen. And so as a child, my mom, who's also a physician, taught me how to bake because she understood my love for science. And the joke in the family is that when I did get married, I couldn't cook, I could bake, and that my husband was going to live on cake alone. So in terms of my repertoire in cooking, I really came to learn cooking later in my life. For me, it became a space of mindfulness and creativity. And I remember talking to my colleagues about, what I would be cooking for dinner. And for me, it wasn't a chore. It was something I looked forward to. And I really started to integrate that as well as my background where, we had several physicians in my family, but we also had a couple of Ayurvedic practitioners. So I came with that holistic mindset into my psychiatry residency training and began to ask more questions about what my patients were doing for lifestyle. Because, Mindy, when I was learning about the psychiatric medications and practicing psychopharmacology, I also saw and read and learned that there were several side effects that came with these medications. And that was how my journey began, just incorporating those questions and being interested in the field, learning nutrition, and wanting to integrate that, because I felt that in medical school, and we know this from research, that many medical schools worldwide have a real gap in nutrition education for doctors, yet we're expected to talk to our patients about diet. And, I think that several U.S. medical schools have tried to change that, but for me, it was a gap. And then my trip to culinary school was really pure passion. Julia Child is my food hero. I would watch her when I couldn't afford cable television, and she was on PBS. And loved it. Right. And when I realized that she went to culinary school later on in her life, I thought, why not me? I wanted to learn how to cook better and enjoy it more. And that was the reason that I did it. And I wish I could say there was a grand plan involved, but there wasn't. I was fortunate that the different passions I followed came together in a really a cool way in terms of the work that I love to do.
Yeah. Now, people may hear the term nutritional psychiatry, and it doesn't mean treating mental health disorders simply with diet. So explain how diet and nutrition can be part of a holistic treatment plan.
Absolutely. It's one major component, and it is what I wrote about as the component in the book. But, in terms of day-to-day practice, when I work with people, it really is about lifestyle changes, movement. When someone is severely depressed and can't get out of bed, you have to find ways that you can engage them around how to get moving, how to sort of mobilize their energy when they're not feeling good. Things like good sleep hygiene, adequate hydration, being dehydrated can precipitate anxiety. So simple things like that. And then other mindfulness practices, whether it's mindful eating, a touch of yoga, tai chi, qigong, other things that make up this more of a holistic model. So it's really looking at the whole person while focusing on the fact that they may be taking medications. Some people may not be. But, remembering, Mindy, that if someone is severely ill, suicidal, losing touch with reality, or manic, an acute psychiatric situation still needs the emergency room and immediate medical care, including possibly medication. So, it doesn't mean diet is excluded, but it can always be part of the conversation.
Yeah. Now, the first chapter of your book is titled The Gut-Brain Romance. So what does the gut refer to? Is it just the stomach, or is it the entire digestive tract? And explain how the gut is connected to the brain biologically.
Absolutely. So, I spoke about the gut-brain connection because of its importance in emerging in mental health. When you refer to the gut, yes, it refers to the digestive system. But, we're talking about the small and large intestine, a little bit more specifically, because the microbiome is really the 39-odd trillion microbes that reside in that portion of the gut. And they really are there to help us. But they can also harm us by setting up things like inflammation when we eat, when we eat the wrong foods that we generally know are not best for our physical health, but it turns out they're also not good for our mental health. The gut and the brain really originate from the same cells in the embryo, and they divide and grow, and as our little bodies grow, they separate out as different organs. So that's important to know. And then there's a physical connection, which is anatomical, physiological, and biochemical, that exists throughout our life from the vagus nerve, which is our 10th cranial nerve, that connects the brain to the gut directly. So I like to call it a two-way superhighway because it's really a bidirectional flow of messages between the gut and the brain. I also think there are two other facts that are helpful for people to know. In the gut, there are more than 90% of the serotonin receptors in the body. And I think that's important because we know that selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors are the medications that we usually prescribe for these conditions like depression and anxiety and others. But, you know, serotonin is often called a happiness hormone, but the receptors are actually in the gut.
That's interesting, research into the connection between gut bacteria and brain function has been ongoing. What's some of the latest research revealing?
So some of the most recent and current research shows, you know, really that there are certain bacterial species that, say, interact with folate from leafy greens. That, you know, there's a certain amount of memory contained in the gut bacteria around things like people who struggle with weight gain and weight loss. There's also, an understanding that plant-based phytonutrients that, you know, we'd always say things like eat the color of the rainbow and have many colors of vegetables in your plate as well as some fruit. The antioxidants in these really need those gut microbes to be broken down in order to be absorbed and give us our best brain benefit. So some of that stuff, while we have known about the ongoing research, I think that it's become more connected to the brain. For example, I spoke recently with Dr. Rudolf Tanzi, who's a major Alzheimer's researcher at Mass General, and he was saying that, you know, they have really seen the connection between not only the inflammation that gets set up in the gut microbiome, say that we're eating poor foods or we're very stressed or there are other conditions, but then it, you know, the neural inflammation or the inflammation in the brain gets set up, and that really has a whole cascade of effects as well. So it's cool to know that it's been shown in different forms of research too.
Yeah. You write in the book, we know our brain needs the proper balance of gut bacteria to make the chemicals it needs to stay stable and healthy. The gut needs your brain to be stable and healthy so that it can maintain the proper balance of gut bacteria. If that cyclical relationship is disrupted, it means trouble for both the gut and the brain. So are there any mental or physical signs that we should be aware of that could indicate that that cyclical relationship is being disrupted?
Interestingly, Mindy, I think it can either present with gut-type symptoms or I've seen it present with mental health symptoms. Because our gut microbiome is so mostly unique to each of us, I've had patients present from, say, a gastroenterologist with depression. And as I uncover the situation and obtain more history, they have real dysbiosis or disruption of the gut microbiome, meaning that the bad microbes have overtaken the good microbes, and there are signs of inflammation. They might have discomfort in the GI system, bloating, and other symptoms that go along with that. And they might be feeling depressed. And it turns out that they might need tweaking from both those angles, both some healing of the gut microbiome, but also some initial care through food initially, or depending on how severe the symptoms are, initially maybe through medication, and then alongside that, always nutritional strategies. But on the other hand, I've also had individuals present, you know, with significant first-time anxiety and panic, but when I've obtained a proper history and uncovered it, the person had never had mental health symptoms, but 18 months prior, talking about a young executive I treated, who had gotten a promotion 18 months prior to meeting with me, and that promotion was very good for her career, but not for her physical and mental health, and that from being someone who ate mostly at home and took lunches to work and generally was eating healthy and working out, she was traveling, eating in airports, eating fast foods, eating junk food, arriving late at hotels in the evening and eating out of the bar fridge because restaurants were closed. And over time, what had happened is, while her career soared, her gut was becoming more and more inflamed and disrupted by these poor food choices, and it presented with severe anxiety and panic. And in that situation, she didn't want to take medication, and she was functioning in the sense that she was able to cope with using nutritional strategies to really have gut healing over time and reduce that inflammation that had been set up, which, like I spoke about with neuroinflammation, had led to symptoms of anxiety and panic.
Do we know if some people are able to maintain healthy gut bacteria with minimal effort, while others might have more difficulty?
I don't know the current most recent data on that, but I would just guess, because we are so mostly unique, that some people struggle less than others. Not dissimilar to how you might have a family member or I might, who, you know, can pretty much, as the expression goes, eat anything and never gain weight. There's certainly those people in the world. And speaking to that kind of research, I would say that some people may be doing better than others and struggle less. But as we know more, Mindy, I think that we're understanding more about how we can adapt how we eat to really maximize our physical and mental health. Because although I say that someone may not gain weight, they might not be mentally the fittest. So, you know, I think that there are different components of that too.
You're listening to The Point. It's our Healthy Lifestyles program. We're talking with Dr. Uma Naidoo. She's a nutritional psychiatrist and author of the new book, This Is Your Brain on Food, An Indispensable Guide to the Surprising Foods That Fight Depression, PTSD, ADHD, Anxiety, OCD, and more. And joining us is one of our regular Healthy Lifestyle guests, Dina Irwin. She's a registered dietitian and nutritionist at the Community Health Center of Cape Cod and registered yoga teacher. She practices integrative nutrition using whole foods, healing, and offers holistic nutrition counseling and cooking lessons through her business, Nourish. Welcome back, Dina.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Dina, you recently wrote an article in the Community Health Center staff newsletter about nutritional psychiatry. How do you see this emerging field impacting care patients receive, and what's been the response of the staff?
So it's been enlightening, I think, to a lot of the staff. People aren't aware of the connection. And I think we're just trying to find ways to integrate it into everything that we do and really look at the whole person, because it's we know that food is medicine and it can have a huge impact on helping people to feel better.
Now, our mood can influence what we eat, but if we are stressed or depressed, we often look for foods for comfort. Dina, what do you hear from patients about eating for comfort?
Oh, so, I mean, everyone's been eating for comfort the past several months, including myself. And, people have a tendency to be really hard on themselves. So one of the things I tend to focus on a lot is just to be kind to yourself. And, you know, maybe give yourself permission to enjoy some of those favorite comfort foods. And we heard Dr. Naidoo talk about eating mindfully and, like, truly enjoy what you're eating without guilt. But also don't forget about all the other healthy foods that are out there and find balance. And really, you know, fill up with some balanced meals during the day so that you feel good, you feel satisfied, you feel nourished, and that can help to actually prevent some of the cravings people tend to have.
Dr. Naidoo, how does sugar and carbohydrates that are also sugars, how does that impact our gut?
I think it's, and hi, Dina, it's great to meet you. Basically, We know from research that added sugars and sugars are not good for the gut microbes. But I think speaking to how we eat when we're stressed, our brain becomes hypersensitive to the rewards of tasty high fat and high sugar foods. And we then crave it more. And I do think that people may not know that there are actual research studies that link the use of those types of sugar to worsening depression and worsening anxiety. So, you know, we almost have to step back from some of those difficult habits that everyone has struggled with during the pandemic, understand that there's brain science behind it, and then move towards, you know, more mindful practice of what can we, by way of example of a healthy recipe or a healthy snack, what can we replace those? You know, if we can think of one habit today that we've developed over the pandemic and we wish to change, maybe it's been a lifelong habit, for some of us. What can we do that would make it a healthy whole food? You know, can we replace a salty pretzel or potato chip with, you know, kale or spinach chips lightly baked in the oven, a whole tray of that with nice spices? That's a yummy, crunchy snack made from a healthy whole food. You know, are there ways to really think out of the box about getting away from those poor habits that we might have developed?
Yeah. So Dr. Nadu, do people with depression have different bacteria in their guts than people who don't?
You know, in certain studies, we know that, but we don't know exactly. What we do know is that there's disruption by what we eat, and that sometimes a person may present with symptoms of depression as a symptom of some of the dysbiosis that has started in the gut. So the inflammation beginning in the gut through, say, a poor diet and stress, as well as other factors. But really, some of the most important things I see are stress changing their diet, and then poor eating habits feeding back to symptoms in the brain and presenting with depression. We know that there are different bacteria, but I'm not sure that we're at that specific point of knowing a person who is depressed has just this gut bacteria that is impaired, because there are 39 odd trillion strains in there of different microbes. Some of them are bacteria.
Right. Dina, if you want to help people incorporate more probiotics or prebiotics into their diet, what kinds of foods or recipes do you point them to?
Oh, I encourage people to incorporate fermented foods into what they're eating every day. One of my favorite breakfasts is overnight oats, which uses some plain yogurt. You know, plus you're getting the fiber from the oats, which is the prebiotic, you know, which goes along with the probiotic. Any kind of fermented food, I love to use as a condiment, like maybe some sauerkraut or some kimchi, thrown on a sandwich or a salad. Cooking with some miso glazed salmon is a delicious, easy recipe to cook. So any kind of fermented food is going to have the probiotic. And then the prebiotic is, you think about fiber, that the prebiotic is what helps the probiotic. So things like onions, garlic, asparagus, green bananas, apples, and any kind of fiber, beans, legumes. That's a great combination to use with your fermented foods.
Okay, you just said green bananas. Oh, I've never eaten a green banana.
Not so green that it's inedible, but an overripe banana does not have the same prebiotic as the slightly green.
Okay. 866-999-4626 is our number if you have comments or questions for us this morning. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Dina, we hear a lot about the low-carb diet, mainly for people who are looking to lose weight, but reducing carbohydrates also means reducing sugar intake, right? So what are some of the foods you steer people toward that are low-carb yet still satisfying?
So I love to encourage people to balance their meals. So yeah, you know, include a small portion of your whole grain food. But if you're just eating that food, you're going to be starving. It's not enough. So I encourage balance, find protein, some healthy fat, a ton of vegetables on the plate. And think about foods that are more low glycemic, like carbs that are in their intact form, rolled oats, Irish steel cut oats, brown rice, quinoa. Foods that are more in their intact form are going to have less of an impact on your blood sugars, especially in combination with the protein and fat.
Yeah. Dr. Nader, you want to add anything to that?
Actually, I do. I think you make some excellent points. And I do think that two emerging areas that bear watching in terms of mental health are elements of the ketogenic diet. And certainly there was some evidence in an Alzheimer's study just about a week ago around use of that type of diet and response in Alzheimer's. So I do think it bears watching. And while I agree with Dana around offering people a whole foods healthy diet, some people might have slightly different goals. And so some of the types of food that I like to suggest is people are wanting to get their fiber from, you know, beans, nuts, seeds, and legumes, but also go like low carb is something like black soybeans, which have lower some of the lowest carbohydrate levels amongst the legumes. So, you know, the little tips like that can help people along. The other point, I think, is the other sort of emerging research is really coming about around intermittent fasting. And how I would frame this in terms of mental health is you really need to be discussing these with your doctor and, you know, paired with a nutritionist because, you know, you may have severe mental health symptoms that you still need to address first while incorporating dietary changes. So I think it's exciting, the new and emerging information that's coming out. And, you know, my philosophy is that I'm diet agnostic, so whether someone's carnivore or vegan, I still have to work with them to find their best nutritional psychiatry eating plan for their mental health.
Yeah. Dr. Naidoo, you talk about artificial sweeteners in the book, something that many people who crave sugar turn to. Are these artificial sweeteners good alternatives to sugar? Do we know if they impact the brain and gut in the same way that sugar does?
Unfortunately, they do cause they are gut disruptors, and most of them do. Research has shown have created problems for individuals. For example, in review of the research on anxiety, several of the sweeteners, including stevia, which I generally think is okay in small amounts for that sweet bite that someone might want, but they did show to really increase the levels of anxiety. So my suggestions and tips around sweeteners are twofold. One is try to rather replace that sweet tooth with low glycemic fruit alternatives. My favorites are blueberries. While blueberries have twice the amount of antioxidants as regular, so, you know, even if they're frozen, that's a good way to start taking care of the sweet tooth that a person might have. And in terms of baking and use of artificial sweeteners, the two that I usually suggest because of their relationship with insulin are either stevia or erythritol, which is sold as Swerve, and it can be used in baking. So, you know, to take care of that, I don't want people to have to give up all things that they like, but create a sense of balance and just use ingredients where the research is guiding us around less of gut disruption or less of a problem in terms of mental health, except in anxiety, where stevia did tend to worsen anxiety in studies.
So we know sugar can dull or depress our mood. Dina, what are the foods or food groups that can boost our mood?
Oh, there's so many mood-boosting foods. You know, in particular, I'm thinking of dark chocolate. Something that's at least 70% dark chocolate is a huge mood booster, at least, you know, for me personally. And you really, it does have some health benefits to it, and you only need a small bite. So especially for people who are having these sweet cravings after meals, sometimes just having, half an ounce, an ounce of that dark chocolate can help, especially kind of the bitter flavor, slightly bitter flavor in it helps to lessen some of the sweet cravings as well. I think of foods like salmon, eggs, oatmeal, green tea, avocado, olive oil. We talked a lot about the fermented foods. And then don't forget about your herbs and spices, too. You know, plants are our friends, and foods that can become a flavorful alternative to some of those sweetened and artificially sweetened beverages are herbal teas. So a lavender tea, holy basil tea, chamomile tea, those kinds of things can boost our mood as well.
Yeah. Dr. Naidoo, anything you want to add to that list?
Yeah, I agree with Dina's list, and I would add, you know, vitamin B9 and B12-rich foods, omega-3 fatty acids in seafood sources like fatty fish. Dina mentioned the salmon miso recipe earlier. I think that's a great choice. So fatty fish, well-sourced, are great options. And then if you're plant-based, you can get your short-chain omega-3 fatty acids, which are the ALA, in things like chia seeds, flax seeds, sea vegetables, algae. And, you know, I love spices, and saffron and turmeric hit the high notes in depression. So adding, as well as, by the way, oregano, lavender, passion flower, and chamomile. So I totally agree with some of those being teas. A great way to get those in. Saffron and turmeric, although I should highlight, had several studies involving an improvement in mood. And my tip with turmeric, if you don't cook with it, is add it to a soup, smoothie, or a tea. But the other hack is always add a pinch of black pepper, because piperine and black pepper activates the curcumin in turmeric, and it makes it so much more bioavailable to your body and brain. And it's a worthy spice of adding in, because on several mental health conditions across the board, research has shown it to be helpful, given it is a powerful antioxidant and anti-inflammatory, just to name two of its mechanisms. So I definitely think embracing spices is an easy, low-calorie or no-calorie, salt-free way to go and boost flavor to your meals.
You mentioned omega-3s. Talk about the impact omega-3s have on our brain.
So interestingly, you know, research began decades ago on omega-3 fatty acids, and they work through an anti-inflammatory effect in the brain as well as others. Mostly it is that salmon eat certain things when they're in the ocean, including algae and krill, which give them the ability to then store the omega-3s in the flesh of the salmon. That being said, what people may not realize is that omega-3 fatty acids have also been tested in human studies on anxiety. So if someone is using an omega-3 fatty acid supplement, you know, it actually might be helping both mood as well as anxiety. I do prefer, I mean, I'm not against supplements. I think they're perfectly fine in for individuals. Just discuss it with your doctor. But I think that one way to really take care of our mental health is to include omega-3 foods, whether they be plant-based sources or sources of fatty fish, such as salmon, mackerel, herring, sardines, anchovies that contain omega-3s.
Dina, you want to add anything to the list of omega-3 foods that you'd recommend?
No, I mean, I love the ideas of fatty fish, and I am a huge proponent of adding chia and flax and hemp seeds. The overnight oats that I talked about earlier, I always throw in some chia and flax in with the yogurt and the oats, and you know, maybe a few walnuts as well for some different types of healthy fats. And it's a really delicious, healthy, satisfying way to start the day.
You're listening to The Point. It's our Healthy Lifestyles program. We're talking with Dr. Uma Naidu. She's a nutritional psychiatrist and author of the book, This Is Your Brain on Food, An Indispensable Guide to the Surprising Foods That Fight Depression, PTSD, ADHD, Anxiety, OCD, and more. Also with us is Dina Irwin. She's a registered dietitian nutritionist at the Community Health Center of Cape Cod and a registered yoga teacher. She practices integrative nutrition using whole foods, healing, and offers holistic nutrition counseling and cooking lessons through her business, Nourish. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Dr. Naidu, let's turn to supplements for a second. Can we take probiotic pills, supplements, or vitamins and expect the same results as eating foods that contain these nutrients?
You know, I prefer healthy whole foods, first and foremost, but there's absolutely nothing wrong with supplements. Some people prefer to take a pill, whether it's a turmeric or black pepper pill or a probiotic or an omega-3. It really depends on the person. I feel that a way to encourage just a healthy basis for eating and nutritional psychiatry practices is to embrace those things through a diet. You know, we technically shouldn't need a multivitamin if we're eating properly, but the truth is that most of us are not. And so taking something to supplement it is perfectly fine. So for me, it depends on the individual. In certain instances, such as saffron, where the amount of spice and the cost of the spice and actually the culinary use is so small in a certain dish, I might then ask a person, if you really want to take a supplement that has saffron, just discuss that with your doctor, because that may be one time when it's a good idea, because it's not you're not going to get the same value from a few threads of saffron in a dish. I would still encourage using it in an ongoing way when you can, but it may not make up for the amount that you need that was shown in research trials.
Mm. Phyllis is giving us a call from Wellfleet. Hi, Phyllis.
Good morning. This is a fabulous, fabulous program. The more specific your experts are about the various foods is really helpful. They made it very clear early on that giving up sugar particularly refined sugar. So I'm assuming, this is both a question and an assumption, that going very low on wine is important. And so I'd like confirmation of that. And the other thing is, the more specific, I've been frantically writing down as many of the things as I can about the various foods. When you're dealing with early onset Alzheimer's, can any of these things help? When I'm assuming that once somebody has shown the effects, there's not much, there's no reversal that can take place. But if there are specific foods that can help keep things at a kind of stasis, I'd like to know that. And we're also overwhelmed with cookbooks and specific chefs. And I know that it's not their role to promote any particular cookbooks or chefs, but some guidance in that direction would be enormously helpful. Thank you
very
much.
Okay, great. Yes, Phyllis, thanks for the questions. Let's start with her question about wine. Dr. Naidu, should she cut back on the wine?
Again, I think this is much, I'd like to put wine and alcohol in a certain context, because I find that it's quite difficult to say to people, just give up an entire, whether it's wine, alcohol, or food group. Yes, alcohol affects our body, including wine. In moderation, I think that's perfectly fine. You know, I'm mostly concerned about the added sugars and refined sugars in food. There are almost 200 or more names for for sugar on food labels. I'd be much more concerned about someone eating a processed, packaged food with added sugars that they don't even realize, including things in savory foods. So with wine, in moderation, red wine has actually shown to be beneficial. Interestingly, studies of cognition have shown that you don't have to abstain from alcohol, but having, you know, having an occasional glass of red or white wine is perfectly fine. I think that with cocktails, people, especially where we know during COVID that alcohol and drug use is on the rise, that when you have a cocktail, the added things like simple syrup and added liquors that are added to make the fancy cocktail is probably what's not helping. If you like a certain, say, liquor that you enjoy, maybe just have it with a splash of soda. Tonic is often sweetened, and so that's also a concern. Maybe a soda water or a splash of something else, or a squeeze of a fresh actual citrus fruit like a lime or lemon, or an actual orange rather than a juice, which has tons of added sugar. Then alcohol needs to be placed in context, right, which is that if you're drinking way too much, you should find a way to address that. But you don't have to give it up entirely for mental health. It's how you manage it and knowing about those extra pointers that I mentioned.
And then Phyllis was also asking about, she talked about Alzheimer's and diet. Yes. And you mentioned Dr. Rudy Tanzi earlier in the program, and I've been to many of his talks, and he recommends the Mediterranean diet. And you also talk about the Mediterranean diet in your book.
I do. And I think that it is, you know, across the board has the most amount of research in terms of improvement of symptoms, for example, like depression. But in terms of actual cognition, it's, you know, that there is the mind diet, which includes a component of the Mediterranean diet as well. So a good way to go. But other things that also hit the high notes with things like cognition are going back to the herbs and spices. Turmeric with black pepper has a significant amount of evidence. There's evidence for use of cinnamon, saffron, rosemary, ginger, and sage. Use of olive oil has been thought to be helpful. So I think that, you know, there are, and in fact, Dr. Tanzi and I spoke about the use of food in terms of, even if someone has some early symptoms, perhaps what the food can do is stave off worsening. So there's really no harm where we have to eat meals anyway to really eat for better mental health and cognitive health at any stage of life.
Yeah, we talked about the pandemic and the increasing stress and anxiety that we're feeling. And Dina, what are you hearing from some of your patients about their stress and anxiety over the past 6 months? And is it impacting what they're eating?
Oh, everyone is has so much increased stress, and yes, it is definitely impacting what they're eating. Although there have been a small group of people who've actually taken the time to go in the opposite direction and found that they had more time to work on their self-care goals. And so it's across the board, but it's really challenging times for everyone. And again, I just encourage people to be kind to themselves and not beat themselves up too much, and to try to find ways to enjoy meals together as a family. You know, sit down at the table, eat mindfully. One of the things that I just wanted to mention really quick is sometimes we don't think about it, how we eat versus what we eat. And if we're eating while we're under stress, it's going to disrupt your whole digestion and metabolism. So sometimes just taking a time out before meals and taking 3 deep breaths and getting into that rest and digest phase and getting out of fight or flight during the actual meal time can have a profound impact on how you're feeling.
Dr. Naidoo, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. You also talk about eating mindfully, and I'm sure there are people going, what does that mean, eating mindfully? And Dina, you sort of described it, but your thoughts on that, Dr. Naidoo.
Absolutely. You know, I love mindfulness with eating because I can tell you as a doctor, when I was an early physician, I would be running around and eating my meals on the go. And I really had to stop and remind myself that that was such a bad habit. So I've been there and done that, and I know that it impacts how we feel emotionally as well as our digestion. It really is about taking that pause, enjoying the meal, you know, shutting off the television and putting our phones on silent and really enjoying either the moment with your family or if you're on your own, you know, having a peaceful moment and savoring the food. I think it makes a very big difference. But the other thing, you know, I feel becomes important is just the fact that life seems so stressed, and a mealtime can be that moment to just step back from the stress of the rest of the day and enjoy what you're doing. And also, I think really focus on the nutrients and what you're eating. Have pleasure in that, because I think that what some dietary advice can do, and I feel that this is one of the reasons I wrote the book, is my patients were coming in confused about what they were hearing every day in different ways, whether they were reading a blog on the internet or information, what should they eat, what's good, what's not good. And I think that, you know, embracing healthy habits in a way with also mindful practice just is a good way to go, given, you know, I consider stress to be one of the vital signs. It's just something we're dealing with every day.
Yeah. And as you're saying, it can be so overwhelming trying to figure out what we should be doing. So, Dina, for people who are looking to make healthy changes in their diet, what are just some pantry staples that we should have on hand?
Oh, I love to have bean pasta in the cabinet. Chickpea pasta is my favorite. It's the only ingredient in it is chickpeas. And some canned seafood is great. Sardines, tuna, anchovies. I love to have foods that only have like one ingredient in them. So again, some legumes, you know, canned chickpeas. Sometimes I'll make a meal out of canned pumpkin. Again, pumpkin is the only ingredient in the can, and I can whip up a soup, a spiced pumpkin soup, with some broth and pumpkin and maybe some coconut milk and some spices.
That sounds good.
yeah, exactly. It's really good. So it's you know, foods that have just one ingredient, maybe two ingredients, that are shelf stable. Let's see. I want to make a tomato soup out of canned tomatoes and canned white beans and some broth and some frozen spinach and some basil and heat it all up and puree it with my immersion blender. That's delicious.
You're bringing up a really good point, Dina, about the number of ingredients. I think people would be surprised as they're going through the grocery store, if you start looking at the labels of the things you're buying, I think people would be really surprised at how much stuff is in some of the products that we buy all the time. So that reading labels, and as you're saying, fewer ingredients, the better. Dr. Naidoo, we mentioned earlier nutritional psychiatry is a holistic approach to treating people. Are you seeing more behavioral health practitioners tapping into the role of diet and mental health?
I think that certain people are. I can't call it mainstream yet, although I'm proud that, you know, Mass General has taken the step to have a clinical service. I would say that functional medicine practitioners and integrative medicine practitioners are more often using these techniques. But I do think that people, we are raising awareness. And, you know, I want to actually just rephrase some of that. Nutritional psychiatry in the book that I wrote is actually based on the current evidence, which is always evolving in nutritional science. And we do updates whenever we can. But my practice of how I work with individuals is more of a holistic model, with nutritional psychiatry being one component.
Medical schools don't typically focus much, if any, time on nutrition, and I think we mentioned that already. But given what we know about the links between diet and physical health and now behavioral health, do you think we'll start seeing changes in medical school curriculum?
So we're actually teaching an elective at the medical school, at Harvard Medical School, for students who want to learn the sort of food as medicine space. I think our efforts throughout the country can be better. I think some medical schools are doing much more in culinary medicine, and I can only hope that this takes on.
Yeah. Just, Dina, just in the last minute or so that we have here, people, again, get so confused, like, oh my gosh, this is like overwhelming, all these choices. As Phyllis was saying, she's trying to write everything down. Just some quick, simple advice for folks who want to eat healthier.
Oh, give yourself credit for every healthy thing that you do. Don't beat yourself up over what hasn't come yet. Think about, like we talked about, those simple meals that you could make out of a few ingredients in your pantries. Don't overthink it. Enjoy what you're eating. Think about, you can have like some frozen vegetables, a can of legumes, and some brown rice, and that's a delicious meal right there.
And keep it simple, yeah. All right, Dina Irwin is a registered dietitian nutritionist at the Community Health Center of Cape Cod and registered yoga teacher. Her holistic nutrition counseling and cooking lessons are available through her business, Nourish. Dr. Uma Naidu is a nutritional psychiatrist. Her new book is This Is Your Brain on Food, an indispensable guide to the surprising foods that fight depression, PTSD, ADHD, anxiety, OCD, and more. And we will post more information about both our guests and at our website, capeandislands.org. Dina and Dr. Naidu, thanks so much for joining us. Very interesting hour of conversation. Thank you.
Thank you, and have a wonderful day.
Thanks. I'm Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.